Thank you for joining us on The Big Idea Show. I'm Michael Anderson, and today we have Jim Welsh on the program. He does a subscription newsletter. It's phenomenal, and it's for folks that are interested in investing and really the deeper learning behind that. He's going to have a lot of great education and information for us today, so very excited about that. Today's show is brought to you by GEICO Local Office, car and homeowners insurance for the 805. You could save up to 15%. Call Greg Mock of GEICO Local Office, 805-487-7847. GEICO Local Office. Here is the all-important disclaimer. I only give advice to clients, and if you're listening, you may not be a client. I don't know your situation. It would be silly to take advice from me, not knowing each other or the situation. So I cannot give you advice without knowing you or your situation. But what I hope to do on this program is entertain you, bring you some relevant education, and bring that your way. So before making any decisions, talk with your legal advisor, financial advisor, or tax advisor. Thank you. We have Jim Welsh here with us today. We're doing a fascinating interview. I'm really excited for this. Jim has published a monthly investment letter, an investment letter since 1985, and it focuses on the Federal Reserve monetary policy, the economy, and financial markets. That does sound a little bit boring, but he makes it interesting. And for everyone out there, this is where the investment advisors, a lot of them go to get insight on this, because he's doing the hard data and research, and he has a fascinating approach. It's not just fundamental analysis, but he also goes into a lot of other stuff. We're going to be talking about that today, and hopefully we will inform and educate you a little bit more about how the markets work, how they're viewed, and kind of what makes them tick. So very pleased to have Jim Welsh on the program today. You can contact Jim online via email. His email is jimwelshmacro@gmail.com, or you can follow him on Twitter @jimwelshmacro. Jim, thank you for being on the program today.
My pleasure, Mike. Glad to be here.
Well, I want to start out just by kind of going over this idea of analyzing the markets, as you have done for a long time, and you publish a very good letter that you put out, and you kind of help digest this information. Let's first talk about the background. How did you get into this?
That's a great question. Many, many years ago, I decided I wanted to learn about the economy and financial markets. Started to go to the library, literally day after day, spending hours, stumbled across a book called Stock Market Logic. And that guy who wrote that book back in 1976 focused on various indicators. And the ones that had the most predictive value were related to monetary policy and interest rates. And so that was my foundation, Mike. And it's really been very helpful going forward in terms of looking at monetary policy, how not only does it affect the economy, usually with a lag of 6 to 12 months, but it has an impact typically in a more short-term basis on financial markets. That analysis basis, if you will, allowed me to kind of anticipate what was going on in 2007 and 8 before it all happened. And in conjunction with monetary policy, as you alluded to, I use a lot of other information to kind of confirm and support the, if you will, the conclusion that I get from monetary policy. So it's I refer to it as a holistic process, because I think in this day and age, you need more than just one tool to really deal with what's going on with financial markets globally.
And let's talk about what you mentioned there, because I think you mentioned some things that people are not familiar hearing about. So you mentioned the lag of monetary policy affecting the markets. Talk to us about, you know, so that's a lag. So the things they're doing now will affect it later. What are the things that lead? And I think this is a common thing. You also talk about this sometimes, leading economic indicators. What are those? What do you look for in those? Give us some highlights on that.
Well, there are 10 separate indicators that comprise the leading economic indicators, and they cover a broad section. Obviously, things like the unemployment rate, but they're also looking at the spread between short-term rates and long-term rates. The stock market is included. Housing activity is included. So it's a lot of nuts and bolts of the economy. But things like spreads between short-term and long-term rates, historically, when they're wide, it means that the economy is functioning fine, liquidity is flowing. But when the Fed starts to raise interest rates, you know, the spread between short and long-term rates narrow is what we've seen over the last year or so. And historically, the equity market begins to, if you will, run out of oxygen and start to struggle. You know, that is one of the better indicators to look at. I think it's lead time prior to recessions is about 10, 11 months. And the key point is historically the largest declines in the stock market, you know, when I'm talking about like 20, 25% or greater, are almost always associated with a recession. And that makes sense because during a recession, corporate earnings suffer significantly, and that is why the stock market responds to it. So it's important to be able to look at things that give a clue as to, you know, is the economy okay? Like right now we're seeing a slowdown. I think it's going to continue to slow for a period of time, but I don't think we're seeing any sign of a recession. And historically, what typically happens in the stock market, and this kind of gets into some of the technical stuff, Mike, but, you know, in a healthy market, the majority of stocks keep going up. And that makes sense. You know, the economy's doing okay. The Fed isn't raising interest rates. But as the Fed begins to raise interest rates, some interest-sensitive stuff like housing stocks and those companies related to housing begin to weaken. And what happens often is that internal measures like the advanced decline line, which is nothing more than taking the number of stocks up today minus the number of stocks that went down, and then doing a running total of that. It's kind of like you're in your checking account. You have a running balance, okay? And when things are going good, the balance is going up. And when things aren't going so good, it starts to decline. And that's what happens usually in the stock market prior to market tops. And that's one of the things that I keep track of very closely, because going back many decades, the advanced decline line had tops out months before the economy goes into recession. So these are some of the tools that I use to kind of put the whole picture together. And at this point in time, again, I think the economy is going to continue to slow, but I don't see a recession, or the signs of recession certainly aren't there quite yet.
And we're going to talk about how you analyze that a little bit as well. We're speaking with Jim Welsh on Twitter, at Jim Welsh Macro. And listeners can receive a monthly letter that he has. He does, it's called Macro Tides and Weekly Technical Review. So he'll highlight all of that. You can find him Twitter at Jim Welsh Macro or jimwelshmacro@gmail.com. Jim, you know, you have a phrase that you kind of talk about, which is marketing is a discounting mechanism. Actually, go through this with me. Market is a discounting mechanism and not.
Yes.
And why contrary opinion is so valuable. So you kind of go into that. Well, tell me about that.
Well, if you listen, Mike, to, you know, CNBC or reading the newspaper, almost every day I hear people say, well, the market is a discounting mechanism, meaning that it's looking out into the future and anticipating positive and negative changes in the economy. And I would say 60 to 70% of the time, that is probably true. You know, over the last few years, the economy's been in good shape, growth has been positive and so forth, and the market's been going up. But at turning point, the market is always wrong. And the reason why that happens is because as the market goes up over a period of years, more and more people, maybe sitting on the sidelines with some cash, gradually put their money in, and that demand pushes prices up. But you reach a point in time where there isn't enough sideline money to keep pushing the market up. And then you get to a turning point where the economy maybe does less well. And all of a sudden, money starts to get withdrawn. And so at turning points, and I think most listeners, you know, if you've owned a home for the last 15 years, you know, remember back to 2005 and 2006, no matter where you went, or yourself, you know, oh my God, I can't believe how much my house is going up in value. It's unbelievable. And it feeds on itself, and you get to a point where everybody who can get in the boat is in the boat. And that's the time to kind of start looking for the opposite to happen. And that's why looking at various indicators in terms of anticipating that things are going to get less well or downright bad is really important. So the whole notion that the market is a discounting mechanism fail at the most critical time, and that is at tops and bottoms. For instance, in October 2007, most people were really bullish, okay?
This is something, I'm glad you're mentioning that because I wanted to ask you about that. You know, I mean, people recognize that, you know, the market's high now. It was really low in March of 2009. That was the bottom. And October of 2007 was the previous peak. And at that time in 2007, how come all of these analysts and like people that are on CNBC, how come they weren't ringing bells saying, hey, everybody, it could be going down. And then we see the Great Recession. But a lot of people were still giving recommendations of strong buy, strong buy. This is still a good market. I think that's what you're going into, right? Talk to us about
like
that.
It's kind of like driving a car. The analogy I use, Mike, is like driving a car looking through the rearview mirror. And it's human nature to expect our recent experience to continue. And, you know, what happens, though, is if you're on a road that's straight, that's great. But at some point in time, there's a bend in the road. And if you're driving the car looking through the rearview mirror, we all know what happens. You go off the road and you wind up in a ditch. And that typically is what happens at major turning points. So you're absolutely right. 2007, people were still bullish. I can say I was one of the few guys who was not bullish. And I was using a lot of the things that we've talked about and some that, you know, we haven't had the opportunity to talk about as to why I thought the economy was going to slow materially in 2008. In January 2008, I said, we're in recession. That was months and months before people jumped on that bandwagon. And in 2009, you're right, March, hey, the market was down. Everyone was negative, expecting, you know, things just to keep getting worse. And yet the market bottomed. So that's my point. If the market is truly a discounting mechanism, what was it telling us in October 2007? That there was no housing crisis about to occur? Or March of 2009, that the world was truly coming to an end? And the fact is, that was not the case. So the idea, and this is treated, you know, with respect, this idea of the market is a discounting mechanism. The market is telling me this and so forth. And it's hogwash. You know, and so to me, that's why one needs to be able to utilize contrary opinion, because when all you hear is people talking why something's going to keep going up, that's the time where you have to detach and say, okay, what are some of the reasons why that may not continue to take place? And only by doing that can you separate yourself from the crowd. It is really one of the most difficult things to do is to go against the crowd. But that's why utilizing things like contrary opinion, using technical analysis to provide, if you will, the conviction one needs to kind of say, hey, wait a second, things are weakening. So in October 2007, the advanced decline line, which I had referenced earlier, had made a peak in June. The S&P went down into August, rebounded, made a new all-time high in October, but the advanced decline line was significantly lower in October than it was in June. Why? Because a lot of stocks weren't participating, you know. So those are the signs that the majority of the people you reference on TV, they don't pay attention to that stuff. Instead, they're saying, well, we think earnings are going to be up 8% next year, blah, 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 blah. And that's what they're looking at. So they're not going to catch turns because that's their mindset. And they honestly don't look at and take the holistic approach that I'm talking about that I really think is necessary in order to navigate the big turns that happen in the market. So contrary opinion is a tough one, but it takes a fair amount of experience and time to develop it, but it's well worth the effort.
You're right on that, and certainly we all have bias. Sometimes we don't even know the bias is there, whether it's the recency bias or the confirmation bias. We all have these things that are there, and there's a lot of psychology that goes into those biases and then also other things that deal with the market, and there's a lot of research and study on behaviors in finance. You talk about it sometimes when you kind of discuss the idea of greed and the emotion of greed versus the emotion of fear, particularly relating to finance. And tell us about that. Briefly, give us a rundown of that, fear versus greed with finance.
Yeah, well, greed is something that happens over time. In other words, everybody doesn't pile into the stock market all at once. It's over a period of time. You know, someone reads an article, then 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, they read another article and so forth, and gradually they warm up the idea of, well, maybe I should put a little bit more money in that stock market. It's been going up and so forth. And when the market tops out, you know, it doesn't just usually turn on a dime unless there's some kind of a major event. It usually takes time. And that's why this erosion underneath the surface begins to take hold in things like the advanced decline line. Conversely, when an event is going on or the market's been going down significantly, everybody's felt that sick feeling in your stomach. you know, and it's like, oh my God, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, my portfolio is down 30%. I don't know if I can take it anymore. You're not alone. A lot of other people feel the same way. And inevitably what happens is fear takes hold and panic in a sense sets in. And as prices go down, it forces even more people to panic. And that's why fear and panic, you make V bottoms. Why? Because it's like a convulsion that happens all at once. So that's the difference between in terms of how it's expressed in financial markets. Greed takes time over a period, whereas fear and panic, you know, kind of come to a point and reach a crescendo. And that typically is what happens in the market. And momentum indicators show, wow, everybody got out at the same time. You get a bounce, and then invariably the market will go back down to near those initial lows. And what one is looking for is less intensity on the selling pressure. And that's typically what happens at every single major bottom over time. The news is still going to be ugly. It's just at the bottom, everybody who pretty much was going to sell, who couldn't take it anymore, has already sold. And as the news then gets less bad, the market takes off from there.
It's fascinating, and this has played through so many times, and it is an interesting thing. We're talking with Jim Welsh, Twitter, at Jim Welsh Macro, and he has Macro Tides and Weekly Technical Review as a newsletter. But it is interesting that this idea of fear and greed has played out so many times. And one thing that I think people are starting to talk about and observe, there's been a lot more passive investors. Oh, I just buy the ETF and I just ride it out. I'm just going to hold it. And if you've done that from 2009 up to now, it's kind of worked out pretty good because the market's had such a great run. But when we have this first kind of V bottom or big drop, what are these folks that are doing it themselves going to do? How are they going to react to that scenario? And I think if history is any judge, they're going to probably sell, and this emotion will hit hold to them, and that will be a kind of a bad time to sell maybe. But
absolutely.
Yeah, and how do you teach people and educate people through the newsletter about the different types of recessions? And that's another thing you talk about I want to get into, which is recessions, and there's different types of recessions. They're not all the same. They manifest differently. Sure. Go into that a little bit.
Well, basically, your garden variety recession is, you know, when you get a slowdown in the economy, and it's usually, again, follows the Fed raising interest rates, liquidity starts to dry up. You think about it, as rates go up, fewer people can afford to buy a car or a house. And as, you know, fewer people do that, then the auto companies lay people off, the housing manufacturing people lay people off. They stop going to malls, so the retailers stop buying stuff. So it filters through. And, you know, that's your normal recession, the one that typically happens. When it develops into a financial, you know, crisis in a way, which is what we saw, obviously, in 2008, the 1930s. 1974 to a lesser extent, where all of a sudden the banking system is really shaky. That is a whole different type of animal, if you will. And typically it's associated with a much deeper, protracted recession, and it requires a much stronger fiscal and monetary response. But the vast majority of them are the Fed raises rates a little bit too much, things slow down, and then the slowdown kind of feeds on itself, and you get a recession. The Fed then cuts interest rates, and, you know, the economy stabilizes, and 6 to 12 months later, we're in a recovery. So I think, Mike, if I'm right about the slowdown, and I think, yeah, is there a risk that a recession could show up sometime next year? Yes, it's just not in the tea leaves quite yet, but I don't think we're going to see a major, you know, if you will, repeat of 2008 until maybe 3, 4, 5 years from now, because the unfunded liabilities of a federal government, the amount of debt, not only in the U.S. but around the world, one of the stats to me that is most scary, in 1982, for every $1 GDP, the U.S. total debt, and this includes government, corporations, households, was $1.60. We're now at $3.40 of debt for every dollar of GDP. So we've used the accumulation of debt over the last 30-plus years to power demand and lift GDP growth. But at some point in time, you reach that point of no return where each new dollar of debt generates less and less in GDP. And that's really what's been happening in the last 10 or 15 years. And it isn't just in the U.S. Some of the statistics, like for Europe and especially Japan, are far worse than ours. So I think somewhere out there, 2023, 2025, somewhere out there, I think there is a much, we're going to see a repeat of 2008, and it has the potential of honestly being more severe. If I'm right about just a slowdown, maybe an edge of a recession in the next 2 years, the Fed is going to cut rates. The Fed will reenact quantitative easing. They'll go with the same game plan they used post-2008. Everyone is going to want to believe that it's going to work. And I think in the short run it will, and the equity markets certainly will respond. But this debt overhang that we have been building for decades, I think at some point in time in the next decade is going to prove very problematic and very disruptive, from a societal standpoint. I mean, we can see how disruptive and divisive things are now, and this is during the second longest economic expansion in our history. What will happen during the next real slowdown? So, I hold my breath when I start thinking of those kind of things. So, again, all I try to do is keep my eyes on the road 100 feet in front of the grill of the car I'm driving and measure what's going on in the economy and the equity market and respond accordingly. But down the road, there's a significant, I think, challenge coming. And, it's one of those things where we light candles and say a few prayers and hope that we have the leadership that we've seen in the past show up when that time comes.
Well, there you have it from Jim Welsh. That is a big call right there, Jim. I appreciate that. Jim Welsh, you can follow him on Twitter. It's at Jim Welsh Macro. We have a couple more questions before we let you go here, Jim. It's interesting. As you're talking about that, it definitely stirs up a lot of thoughts. But one of the other comments that I wanted to ask you about, and you're kind of talking about it there as well, but what are some of the impacts on financial markets as we see the unwinding of the quantitative easing that's been happening? And as they unwind to that, how should markets be responding? What can we expect there?
Well, we've already seen it, Mike, this year. That's a great question. And this is something I wrote about months ago, that if you look at central bank balance sheets, not just the Fed, but the ECB, Bank of Japan. As the Fed was trimming its balance sheet, the Bank of Japan was expanding its. The ECB, they're shaving it down, but they were still expanding it. But what we've seen since about May of this year is the rest of the world's financial markets have suffered, across the board, double-digit type declines. And so to me, that reduction in liquidity and the rate of change of liquidity that was boosting not just our equity market, but global markets, just the change in the negative, in the rate of change of the growth has already manifested itself in bear markets in almost every market except the U.S. And that is going to accelerate, I think, in 2019. And is one of the reasons why, I think sooner or later, the U.S. market, I think the S&P has the potential to be down 10 to 20% at some point in time in 2019, and then we'll see some kind of a trading low and then another big move up, I believe. So, the change in liquidity and what the central banks are doing was very beneficial for years. And as they're pulling away from that, and the Fed has addressed this in terms of raising the federal funds rate up to a neutral rate, I think they're going to continue to do that. I think people have totally misread Powell's speech on Wednesday. They didn't understand where the Fed was coming from before the speech, and I still don't think they recognize where he's coming from now. I think the Fed is still on the path to raising rates until they're dissuaded otherwise. So that's going to play a significant role in 2019, if I'm correct. I think inflation is going to pick up more than people realize. The drop in oil price, the Fed didn't pay attention when it went from 50 to 75 because they exclude the price of oil from their gauge of inflation. So they're not going to pay attention to it from 75 to 50. We don't have time to talk about some of the technical reasons of why oil probably dropped from 75 to 50. But bottom line is, I think the Fed is on the path of raising rates gradually, and they will continue to do so unless the economy truly shows signs of some wear and tear. Then they're going to respond accordingly. That simple.
We're talking with Jim Welsh. JimWelshMacro@gmail.com is his email. Jim, I follow and I appreciate there's not a lot of stuff out there with Stan Druckenmiller. And mm-hmm. One of the things he always talked about is it's one thing to see someone on TV talking about this stuff. But if they're not managing people's money, if they don't have someone's real money at risk that they're trying to make decisions on, then their opinion may carry less weight. Because it's a different thing when you're actually dealing with real money and it's someone else's money and you're really making decisions on it. So there's more weight to it, or there's more, you just have to be more engaged. But who are some people that you appreciate, respect, and follow that are relevant today on Twitter or otherwise?
Yeah. Druckenmiller, obviously, he has something to say. I want to listen. Ray Dalio, Jeff Gundlach. Those are probably three of the people that, all right, I know they're thoughtful. They're not always right, but I know that they are thoughtful. And they understand, I think, the bigger picture better than, most of the other people that we get to listen to. So
I appreciate that. And before we close, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just thank you very much, Mike. I wish you, your family, and everyone listening a healthy and happy holiday. And here's to hopefully a prosperous 2019.
And that's Jim Welsh. Jim Welsh does Macro Tides and Weekly Technical Review. It's a subscription newsletter. You can get more information. Email him, jimwelshmacro@gmail.com, or go to Twitter, @jimwelshmacro. Jim, thanks for your time today.
I appreciate it, Mike. It's always really a pleasure to be able to talk about things for a little bit of an extended time. And I thank you very much for having me on your show.
Now it's time for the Nonprofit Spotlight with your host, Michael Anderson.
And today's Nonprofit Spotlight is brought to you by Era Energy, powered by safety, innovation, and community. We help keep California moving forward. A real brief financial Nonprofit Spotlight today is a website I would love for you to check out. It is National Endowment for Financial Education, and their website is nefe.org. That's the National Endowment for Financial Education. There is a lot of great links on this website that will help you learn more, help essentially whatever life stage that you're at, whether you're in high school, college, or beyond. There's some really good information that they've curated here, and you can learn more about your financial information. Would love for you to check it out. It is free and is the National Endowment for Financial Education. That is nefe.org. Well, that does it for our show today. Be sure to stick around and listen to the Career Pathway Show. That's going to be coming right up. And thanks for your time and energy. We hope you appreciate the content we're trying to bring to you. This couldn't happen without our sponsors. Big thanks to the team at Geico and also to the team at Boyd & Associates, the largest financial-owned security company in Southern California, established in 19. 19-